Oh, hello there. Today's episode of The Biscuit is brought to you by Hairless Ape Conspiracies, the greatest fucking t-shirt you'll ever own. The new long sleeve hoodie, Violence is a Gift, hoodie is out right now. Go buy it. Use Biscuit10 at checkout. Save yourself 10%. The new line is going to be out soon. The old line is incredible. Do yourself a favor. Go pick yourself up a t-shirt. Go read the blogs. Go listen to the episode I just did with Sam Burns. Hairless Ape Conspiracy is the fucking best. I guarantee it. I also guarantee you'll feel better if you take your raggedy ass over to Mount Vernon, Ohio, and go to Lucid Float Spas and get in the Depri. Depri? What the fuck? Sensory deprivation tank. Holy shit. And go take a float, get in the salt water, feel better, get a massage by Chad. Tell him the biscuit sent you, save $30 off your first float. And as always, we are brought to you by ParkersPlatoon.org, a nonprofit organization started by Scott Parker, his wife Francesca Parker, and their son DJ Parker to help one veteran at a time. On today's episode, I have the incomparable Doug the Thug Smith, author of Goon, Memoir of a Minor League Hockey Enforcer, which was later adapted into a little film you might know called Goon. Then the sequel, Goon, The Last of the Enforcers. Doug is a fucking true blue American, a badass motherfucker, and it was absolutely an honor to be able to spend some time and talk to him today. Like I told him at the end of the episode, you know, you have a list, a dream team of guys you want to get on the show, and Doug Smith is definitely one of them. So I hope you guys enjoy. Doug Smith, everybody.
Now Probert got the right hand free.
He's loose with the right hand, and he starts to retaliate, and down goes Nylon, and the two of them are hammering each other.
Knights of Columbus, that hurt!
It's old time hockey, the way you're supposed to play. You throw a little lumber if a guy gets in your way.
The enforcer of all hockey podcasts. It's The Biscuit. It's The Biscuit.
Damn it! That school regulation size of what?
The enforcer of all hockey podcasts.
God help the fucking day if fighting's ever banned. There's a country we'll stop working on so bad this fucking can.
Hi, everybody. It's The Biscuit Podcast.
Hey, you want to go? Yeah, okay. Good luck to you too, bud.
All right, Biscuit Babies. Today, I am joined by the legendary Doug Smith, enforcer, police officer, coach, author, actor. There isn't much this man doesn't do. Doug, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, it's an absolute pleasure. You're sort of a legend in the fight world as far as hockey goes. Even the book Goon is kind of like, oh, do you have the first edition of that? Which no one has. But how's that feel to kind of be looked in that light?
You know, the whole my whole journey was just a mistake, to be honest with you. It was just something I did as a whim, and it just happened to pan out. And you know, for those people that don't really know me or my story, I mean, I never played hockey as a kid growing up. I actually didn't start skating until I was out of high school. I was 19 years old, and I just wanted to skate on the lakes and the ponds in my area just for fun with my buddies. And, you know, the whole hockey thing evolved real quickly within a couple of 2-3 years after that. And it only happened because I had a boxing background. I was an amateur fighter as a kid growing up. I fought in all the local tournaments, the Golden Gloves and things like that. And, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, unlike today, hockey allowed you to fight on a regular basis, and they would employ a tough guy and let, you know, guys that were willing to drop their gloves have a spot on a roster, whether it was pro or minor league. And, you know, I was just really able to capitalize on being athletic enough to pick up hockey, skating, balance within a couple of years period, and then implement my fighting background. And that's kind of how it all started.
Absolutely. And like you said, you picked it up, you know, skating at 19 and were playing in the minors by the time you were 21, which is just absurd. I know you're a very humble man and, you know, say it was a mistake, but I mean, you put a lot of work into getting better, not only as a fighter on the ice, but really working on your skating too. Once you had that inaugural year, you know, really wanting to be the best you could be.
I did. And I mean, I kind of had a focus and a dream that, you know, I realized that I had kind of broken through the level that I was at. And I said, geez, you know, if I really can just work on my skating and actually just learn to play the game a little bit better, because that's what all the scouts and coaches were telling me. They would say, Smitty, you know, we know you got big balls and we know you'll fight anybody. You just got to work on your skating because, you know, to put you out on the ice, we as coaches have to be smart. We got to put you out, say, in a stoppage of a play and line you up next to the guy we want you to take out. We can't put you in during the flow of a game and have you jump the boards while the play is going up the ice because my skating just really wasn't all that good. And so you're right. I certainly did work hard at it. I mean, you know, I was humbled by going to power skating schools in my area where I would be 21 years old at 6'2", 250 pounds, skating with 8-9-year-old kids, just trying to learn how to skate and
right.
do circles and do stops and starts. I mean, it was awful, but I mean, you know, I just kept saying to myself, just, you know, grind it out, keep working hard every day, you know, do the right things, and maybe it'll pan off.
And you're a Massachusetts guy, too, so it's kind of that, you know, put your nose to the grindstone mentality that they have on the East Coast there, where even, you know, with your amateur boxing status before that, I mean, getting a runner-up at the Golden Gloves is nothing to shake your head at either. And then deciding, I mean, I'm sure you watched hockey being from the Boston area, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, I grew up being a Bruins fan and, you know, I did like the game. I just never actually played in it. And truthfully, I really only watched it just because of the fighting. I mean,
right.
The Bruins had some incredible fighters back in the day. And, you know, so did the majority of the league. I mean, you know, the Broad Street Bullies were infamous. And, you know, every team had to. I mean, you had to employ a tough guy or you were dead. And so I did enjoy watching the game. I just never really picked it up for whatever reason.
Right. And, you know, you're one of those guys that, you know, there's people who fight in hockey, then there's people who like to fight in hockey. You're definitely in the latter there where you really enjoy fighting. It's not like a problem to you. It's almost second nature.
Well, I definitely had the fighting background, like I said earlier. I mean, the boxing, since I was 13, 14 years old, it was second nature to me. I wasn't afraid to fight. I wasn't afraid to get hit. And I would talk to lots of guys after fights, guys that I just fought or other tough guys from other teams around the leagues, whatever league I was in, American League or IHL, East Coast. And I would agree with you that the majority of guys fought only out of necessity. They had to, either because of their size, they were a big guy, and they either got picked on or, you know, challenged because of their stature, or just guys that knew that this is their only ticket out of the minor leagues. And, you know, if I'm willing to drop my gloves and fight the other team's heavyweight, I might get brought up. I might get noticed. And a lot of guys did it, even though they really didn't want to do it.
Right. Well, that's a huge part of the book, too. I mean, there's a few chapters where you talk about guys, you know, fighting at camp to at least get a roster spot. But then after that, if they got a little comfortable maybe with, you know, okay, I know I'm going to be a part of the team all year, you couldn't entice them to drop the gloves and kind of made it tougher for guys as yourselves to be comfortable and be like, well, I'm constantly on the 7-day contract, you know, drop your gloves. Come on, let's go, guy.
Right. And that entire scenario that you just described is how I got my first job with the East Coast Hockey League, Winston-Salem Thunderbirds back in like 88 is, I lost in a fight to a guy, or he was just a little bit better than me in camp. And he could certainly play a lot better than me. He was a good skater. He was a big kid. And, you know, we had two fights in camp and I did well, but he just was a little bit bigger than me. And I remember the coach saying to me, Smitty, I'm just going to keep this other dude around because he's a little bit better player. And exactly what you just said happened. You know, he got comfortable there. He figured he made the team. And as the season started to progress, 8, 9, 10 games in, he just decided that he wasn't going to fight that much anymore. excuse me, and he was going to be more of a player. And at that time in that league, you know, you had to be a tough guy. And,
right.
He got released. I got called back, and I stayed the rest of the year, and our team won the championship that year.
And how great of a feeling is that, man, to be an ECHL Riley Cup champ, 88-89, and be recognized by the captains of that team to receive a ring in professional hockey, dude. I mean, that's just incredible.
Yeah, it was huge. And I didn't play during the playoffs because, obviously, again, you know, my skating wasn't at to that level. But my teammates acknowledged that, you know, I helped them get to that point. You know, I you know, stood up to all the challenges and all the tough guys that wanted to beat us up and chase all our skilled guys around. And they felt like I deserved a ring for my, you know, participation during the season. And believe me, I cherish that honor because, you know, besides a wedding ring, it's the only ring I own.
And I mean, you went over 170 PIMs that year too, for that team. And then even during the playoffs had an opportunity, you know, cause guys, you know, enforcers would kind of swing from team to team to team as much as, you know, somebody would need it. And, you know, you had an opportunity to go play for, it was Johnstown, correct? And pass
I had two teams, Knoxville and Johnstown. They were playing each other in the first round. And when my name went on the, whatever list you call it, where you're not inactive, so to speak, I know both teams had called over for me and to see if I would, you know, jump ship. Carolina said if I wanted, they would release me so I could go play with one of those guys. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So I want to stay with these boys. You know, I've been fighting for them all year. I don't want to leave. And I didn't. And I'm glad I didn't because it paid off for me.
Absolutely, man. And I know there was guys on the team going, you know, Doug, you're crazy. You can go make more money. And, you know, I'm sure it crossed your head, but like you said, at the end of the day, you know, you're a man, you own two rings. One of them's a championship ring from the ECHL, man. That's awesome.
Right. And, you know, money back in those days was a big deal. I mean,
right.
It's Coast League. You don't get a lot of pay. You know, you got to share an apartment with, like, six guys. You know, you're like a bunch of immigrants living somewhere. It's just the way it is.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about, you know, in Goon, your memoir, there's, many parts where you're like, you know, I was lucky to get it was a feast to get a tuna fish sandwich. Like,
yeah, I mean, we ate the same shit every night. It was pizza and salads and just cheap money meals. And, you know, like I said, to jump to another team for an extra week's pay, because, I mean, if you think about it, really, I mean, the playoffs were only five games.
Right.
And you could be eliminated three in a row and you're going home. And is it really worth me leaving my team to go play for somebody else for a lousy three games? And then I'm going home on the bus. So I just, you know, in the big picture, I just felt our team was a great team. I had some really cool cats that I got to know and room with. And I just wanted to hang out and, you know, be a part of it.
Well, and you guys caught fire there at the end of the season, too. I mean, five teams in the league, I think, at that time, four of them make the playoffs. And you guys end up finishing the year strong as hell, you know, beating out, I forget the other team, but I mean, going into it, you're rolling and you had been and literally bled for those guys. And I think that was one of the at least, you know, from an outside standpoint, one of the better correlations from Goon the book to the film, where, you know, Doug Glatt in that film literally would do anything for those guys. And I thought they captured that well. I was like, well, that's directly from, you know, Doug Smith.
Yeah, that was a definite quote, so to speak, that I think, I don't know if it was actually, I said it in the book, but I certainly said it when I was, you know, sitting with the people who wrote the script for the movie. And, you know, they would always pick my brain and ask me certain scenarios. What would you do if this happened? What would you do if that happened? And at somewhere along the line, I remember saying, you know, I would bleed for my team.
Yeah.
And they caught that, and I love them for catching that. It wasn't that I purposely said it. It was just something that just came out of my mouth. But they happened to catch it, and they ran with it throughout the movies, and I love that.
Well, that's what made that movie, in particular, the first one, like a cult classic, where it wasn't just, you know, American Pie on Ice. It wasn't just some silly fight movie. There was some serious shit in it, and lines like that where he's sitting down with Ray, where you're like, oh man, like, and always in the back of your head, you're going, well, this is a true story. You know, rather not, if you've read the book or not, you're going, well, this is about a guy. So it makes you really connect with Doug as a character in the film.
Right, and I don't want to mislead, you know, people, so to speak. I mean, the book was obviously, you know, an autobiography. It was all authentic. The movie isn't 100% authentic. Obviously, there's some Hollywood script written into it. I mean, right. You know, I didn't wear white figure skates to training camp. I don't eat corn dogs, and I'm not Jewish. But, I mean, there's a couple of funnies in there, obviously. But, you know, for the majority of it, like I said, the serious stuff that a hockey fighter fan and a hockey fan in general, you can pick up on different parts of the movie. You can almost, you know, distinguish what was real and what might just be Hollywood, you know, script.
Yeah. Now going back to being in that, in the bus and riding in the bus and, especially that first year, the bus, the tin can,
the sardine can.
Did you ever feel like, man, I'm dying in this bus today? Like this thing is not going to make it.
Yeah. We broke down all the time. We'd be on the side of the highways forever, for hours and hours. We'd always be getting repair tow trucks coming out to get us going. And, you know, we'd be freezing our balls off because the heat wouldn't work if the bus didn't run. So, I mean, it was a horror show. But, I mean, for me, I'd be sitting in the back of the bus just, like, laughing and giggling because this is, like, the life of a minor league pro hockey player that I shouldn't be having because, you know, 2 years ago I was just washing dishes at a restaurant in my hometown.
Right.
So, I mean, I was eating it up, and I don't care if they told me to get out and change the spare tire on the bus. I would do it because I was loving it.
That attitude kind of had, I mean, it had to wear off on the other guys too. I mean, some of them vets in there had to go, well, I mean, look at rookie in the back, just smile on the face. I mean, that's got to be infectious at some point.
I think the veterans were really good with me. They accepted me, obviously, but they, like you said, they played me almost as a role model. They would use me against the guys that came in that were all skill, thought they were the cock of the walk, and didn't have to work hard, or didn't have to show up, or didn't have to do the things that you do as a teammate. And those veteran guys used me as an example. They would say things like that. You know, look at Smitty doing this and doing that. You guys should be doing stuff like that. So it did work out into my favor, which I think really garnered me a lot of respect throughout my team and the league. Because, you know, your name and your reputation travel way ahead of you. So I think I got a decent rep through all of it.
And I would imagine that respect from those guys would carry you through any kind of bullshit talk where they go, oh, well, Doug can't skate. He's just a, you know, quote-unquote goon. When you could just brush that off and go, well, I've got the respect of the guys in the room. Or, you know, all the media writing, you know, just trying to trigger shit. Where you could just go, it doesn't matter. I mean, I've got these guys in here loving everything I'm doing. And all that hard work you're putting in paying off. I mean, I don't know a lot of guys who trained for fighting like you did. I mean, you talk about preparing your knuckles by punching buckets of sand, and you could watch your hand transform as you're getting ready to fight, being like, well, my hands are as strong as they could possibly be. Did you get that from guys at the gym from your boxing days, those kind of things, to strengthen your wrists and hands, or is that just stuff you kind of made up along the way going, well, this has to help?
Well, that sand in the bucket trick, that was actually something I picked up from a Chinese karate instructor who used to tell me, you know, if you want to toughen up your hands and your knuckles, get yourself a 5-gallon bucket of sand and just punch into the sand, sit in front of it and just, you know, while you're watching TV and just punch into it. And, you know, that the front of your knuckles and your fingers and your hands will just start to get really rough and tough and thick like leather, and they won't split open. Because the worst thing to do is be punching helmets that you can't get off.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can't take the time to try to pick off a guy's helmet. You know, he's flailing away and you're getting tagged with shots. You just have to return fire the best you can. And taking a few seconds to try to get a helmet off just doesn't work sometimes. So instinctively, you just throw wild sometimes. And if you catch a helmet, you bust your hand open. You know, not only could you obviously break your hand, but just those deep lacerations, those little fucking things nag forever, and they hurt like a bastard, and you can't get rid of them. They just last forever because you keep breaking them open every fight. And believe me, my goal was to get 2 fights a game. If I got 1 fight a game, I'd almost cry myself to sleep because I'd be scared that I was going to go home. They're going to shit can me.
Well, yeah, there's you know, after every game you're calling, you know, in the book, Gator, but going, I only got two fights tonight. I'm fucked. I'm going to get sent home out of here. Like, I just love that mentality you had, man. It's, you get amped, you know, reading your story. You're like, oh God, this guy was just amazing, man. And that's actually a question I had is, you know, how hard is that to do, to have your hands cut up or have a swollen eye and know, oh shit, this is Friday. I have to fight tomorrow and Sunday. How hard is that to know that you have to do, and maybe I'm going to get punched in this bad eye again?
Yeah, again, I mean, I can reflect back to my boxing where I, you know, did a lot of, I mean, I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of rounds of just sparring alone, preparing for fights. Excuse me. So I would know how to treat cuts and treat abrasions. And, you know, so I had little tricks of the trade that I could get away with. I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon for me to fight somebody on a Friday night, and maybe if I caught a shot in the eye, you know, I would go to the local hospital on a Saturday morning, and I would get like a inswell, like a steel piece of metal that they would give you, you know, or get treatment because I knew I was fighting that night. Like I would sneak over to places and get treatment because I knew I had to fight the next night. I couldn't be laid up. And, you know, I'm not going to say that I was like a warrior or some sort of madman.
I'll say it.
It was just something that had always been embedded into my head anyway since I was like 14. I just knew how to just, you know, overcome those issues. But there were issues that you had to overcome.
Right.
Because you couldn't be on the bench. You just couldn't be in the stands. You couldn't be out of the lineup. You had to be there no matter what.
Right. And, I mean, and you didn't want to be sitting in the stands watching or – you know, no. On the bench. You wanted in that action and, you know, right. As much, you know, as you could. Yeah.
And I was going to say, you know, like you said, I don't want to be there. You're right. And my coach even said to me, Smitty, even if I don't skate you on the ice, you're an insurance policy on this bench. Just sit at the end of the bench. They know you're there. And if someone acts up, they know you're here.
Boom.
And if they see before the game that Smitty's up in the stands eating popcorn with a shirt and tie on, we can act like assholes tonight because no one's coming after us.
Yep.
So just to be on the bench alone was an insurance policy.
Especially after you got in there and got a few fights in, because you break in the league in 88 in the ECHL, so there's no internet. There's, you know, this is word of mouth, so people have to find out about Doug Smith from playing, and then, you know, fighters kind of spread the word, or, you know, if the game was actually recorded, then people can, you know, trade tapes that way. I mean, you mentioned yourself being like, I don't know how this guy's going to fight. I mean, you try your best to kind of get that information, but when you were sitting on the bench and getting ready for the games, I really enjoyed the parts of your story where the coach didn't have to tell you, hey, Doug, 33, get him. You were so focused on watching the game and, you know, really measuring in on who was playing fuck around with your guys and who was going to get it when you crossed over that bench.
Right. And I mean, you already know ahead of time as a fighter who the other team's heavyweights are. That's a given. And you're right. Like you said earlier, you know, your name and your reputation spread quickly throughout the league, despite videos or, you know, whatnot. I mean, I was fortunate my first year, my first four games, I did very well against four legit heavyweights in that league. And so my name exploded. So then it was one of those things where, well, I know now I have to show up, like, because the fans are expecting it.
Right.
My teammates are expecting it. And goddamn, I'm expecting it because that's why I'm here.
Yeah.
So, but you're right. I mean, it's just one of those things where, you know, I believed in trying to get a little leg up if I could on these guys who were strangers to me because they had all been there maybe a year or two in advance too. They all knew each other. So to find out who was a lefty and who was a righty or, you know, who did what when they fought, that was just part of the homework that you had to do as a fighter.
And you could switch hands, couldn't you, pretty easily?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I had the fighting background. So taking a punch, I was never afraid of. I never got knocked out. I took some real good shots from some big name guys through my career and never went down. Got busted up pretty good. But, you know, never went down. And I could switch hands, which was huge in hockey fighting. Most guys were either a lefty or a righty, and that was it. And if I knew ahead of time that, you know, hey, I'm fighting William tonight, he's a righty. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go righty, try to lock him down. And, you know, I know if I stop his right, he can't switch with his left. And, you know, you just try to just get come up with some sort of a strategy, you know?
Yeah, my strategy, if I'm fighting you, is I'm skating the way as fast as I fucking can. That's my strategy.
well, that's you, so to speak. Don't take this the wrong way. But, you know, the other guys in the other team, the other heavyweights, they weren't like you.
Right.
A lot of them were like me.
Right.
They were looking for me just like I was looking for them, because everyone wants that, you know, that one last bout that might catch someone's eye that says, hey, this kid's ready to get called up. Or, you know, someone's in the stands watching a scout from another team. You know, so it was a great start for me, so to speak, you know, at that level, because everyone was kind of similar. You know, we were all just trying to climb that ladder.
Yeah, that's really crazy to think about, that you guys all were the cocks of the walk. Like, and you're not getting in a fight in that league if you didn't think, I'm going to knock this guy out. So, I mean, that makes even what you guys did even elevated higher, where there's two heavyweights going, we're the baddest motherfucker on the planet. Let's do this.
Right.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool stuff.
That's really cool. And then it's, in the minors then too, I lost myself there for a second. Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm super excited, man. But, back then, too, there was an incentive of maybe getting a little bit of cash in your pocket, too, for fighting. So that's in a day where, you know, tuna fish sandwich is the king. You're going, shit, if I can get myself another extra $50.
Yeah, I'm having steak tips tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And a lot of guys had incentives through their contracts. A lot of guys had, I remember a kid named Greg Batters. I mean, he was down in Knoxville, and he was under the LA Kings contract, and he was up in the American League for, I think, a very short time, and they got sent down to the East Coast League, and, you know, they basically said to him, you know, if you can get X amount of fights or X amount of penalty minutes, you know, you'll get a bonus in your check, just like incentives of all athletes get today.
Yeah.
And I didn't have anything written into my contract, but I can tell you one thing. When I was at home, in front of the home crowd, and if the owner of the team you know, was at the game, which most of the games he was, and he could see the audience go berserk when I dropped my gloves and fought somebody, he would run down all the time and throw me a fistful of cash. It might be $30, it might be $100. But, you know, he was happy with my performance because the fans were happy. And back in that day, you got to remember, I mean, we're down in the South. All they care about is blood and guts. They don't care if your team. They don't care if you won the game or lost the game. They're rednecks. They want to see fights.
Yeah.
Here's a Yankee from Boston down here in the southern states fighting for us, and we love this kid. And they used to yell at me. They'd call me Yankee Doodle and all this shit, but they loved it. They thought it was great because they knew I was the guy that was going to drop the gloves and fight. That's what they came out on a Friday night to watch after a hard work week for them.
The old black and blue bonus, man.
Right, right. But like I said, I didn't have it written in my contract, but I know a lot of guys did, and it's a good incentive, you know, because that's what the fans want to see back in that day.
Yeah, it's and speaking of batters too, that was one of the that's the end of the end of the game fight you got into. There was the kid, the Benson kid, who was kind of a college kid, and I know you weren't the biggest fan of college kids to begin with, and that was a game where the owner had told you, like, okay, Dougie, we got to get something going here, and you didn't have the opportunity throughout the game. So could you just touch on how that brawl went down? It's super unfortunate that we can't find it on tape. I mean, you mentioned in the book, and there was just kind of how it was back then. Not everybody was filming.
Believe it or not, it is on tape. You might be able to find it on YouTube because I've seen it, and I know I have it. But what happened was, this one particular kid, and I think his name may have been Benson, like you said, college kid, and they were in our home rink, so we're in Carolina. It's my hometown, and they're beating us up pretty good in the scoreboard. You know, and that college kid probably had, you know, two or three goals for the night, but the celebrating after, you know, the raising his arms and, you know, showing off and all this stuff. And that pissed off the team, our team, that obviously the fans hated. And I couldn't get out of the ice to go after him because, you know, even though we're down two or three goals, we still have an opportunity to maybe, you know, catch up or win. So, again, having me out there wasn't a necessity. And the game wasn't a violent game at that point. So anyway, what happened, long story short, is at the end of the game, I went after that kid
yeah.
for showboating, for acting like a little dick, you know, and I pounded him down to the ice. And Greg Batters, who I totally respect. I had already probably fought him 3 or 4 times that year. He was a great guy. He literally just stood there and waited till the fight was over. He didn't third man in. He didn't jump in. And as soon as the fight was over, I remember it as if it was yesterday. I just remember hearing him yelling, "Smitty, Smitty, over here, over here." And he literally called me out of the group. And we went kind of like behind the net. And we squared off with each other. And then we had a tilt, which was great. And when I tell you, like, fans going berserk, I mean, it was nuts. That was a game where the owner came down and gave me cash. I can tell you that. He loved me that night. But the point was, you know, hey, listen, the Benson kid who was celebrating and overreacting to his goals in our home rink, you can't do that. So you got beat up.
Oh,
and then their heavyweight did his job. He stood up to me, and I answered the challenge, and it was a great fight, and the fans loved it. And the fans, what do? They come back next week, which is what the owner wants.
Yeah, and you and Batters can go have a beer, you know, afterwards, because it's no big deal. You guys both know what's going on, and that's what happened. It was business as usual back then.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, because I was so new to the sport and the game, especially the fighting aspect, it would blow my mind, and my friends wouldn't even believe me when I told them that how after just fighting a guy in a game, you could hang out with that same guy afterwards and shoot the shit with him for hours as if it never happened. It was a great fraternity.
It's kind of a like-mindedness where you're like, well, you know, I've had fist fights with a few of my good buddies, and sometimes it just happens, and then, I mean, instantly afterwards, you're not mad anymore.
Right, right. And I think I started to learn the concept that it was basically, it was just a business. And I don't hate you, or I'm not, you know, I don't dislike you, I don't even know you, but it's just a business. You know, you're employed by this team for that reason, and I'm over here for this reason, and, you know, if we meet, we meet. And, you know, but afterwards, you kind of just shake hands and you shoot the shit, and they're all good guys. I mean, there really wasn't any one asshole. They're all decent guys.
There was one asshole that people seemed to mention a bunch back then, but, I mean, even you said you didn't really mind him that much.
Who's that?
I think it was Aubrey.
Yeah, you know, when I first met Ron Aubrey, and today, let me first stipulate and say that today is a different day. Today, Ron and I are good friends. We still connect with each other. We're on Facebook together. You know, you just, when you're in that, I don't know how to quickly explain it, but, you know, when you're in that environment back in the day, you know, it's intimidation has a lot to do with it. And sometimes just the way you act rubs people the wrong way. And I wasn't the type of guy where I was, I just wasn't intimidating. You know, I just didn't have that face. I didn't have that body. You know, I was only 6'2", 245, 250. You know, Ron Aubrey's like 6'4", 260.
Yeah.
And he's tough looking. Like, he's a tough looking guy. Like, if you look at him, you back down because he's just a tough looking kid. And I had that, I had that baby face. I was brand new to it. Despite all the boxing I ever did, you know, I guess I was lucky. I didn't catch a lot of shots over the fights that I had. But nevertheless, you know, Aubrey, even though I would try to talk to him once in a while or whatnot, he just didn't seem to, want to play that game. And so for whatever reason, I just thought he was an asshole when I first played against him. And then as time went on, you know, he lightened up a little bit and, you know, I kind of was just the way it was, and, you know, I understand. I get it, you know.
Yeah, and it's kind of, you beat up a couple guys, too, and you kind of have that, you know, standoffishness. You'll probably get some, and I know a few guys said he would be prone to jump guys and shit like that, but it's, there's always one, right?
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't into that. I mean, I never really jumped guys. I just didn't believe in it, and I personally like the idea of dropping the gloves, putting the show on a little bit for the fans, squaring off again, kind of like boxing, and just, you know, hey, listen, if you eat a few and you go down, you lose. That's the way it goes. But to try to jump a guy from the side or get him before his gloves off, and, you know, maybe sucker him a couple shots, that wasn't my game. And although I never experienced that with Ron, maybe he had done that to other people. I don't know.
Right.
But, you know, all my fights with him were really good fights. I won a couple, he won a couple, and, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, there's even a part where you talk about, you know, a one fight that might have even left a bad taste in your mouth against Misiak, where, you know,
yes.
You know, and it's the only one where you're in your career where you're like, man, I didn't. And you can go back and watch that fight, and you can tell when you drop him that you're like, oh shit, like.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that fight, and I mean, I was playing for Johnstown, and we had talked before the game. He was just like me, dude. This kid was the best. He loved fighting. He was awesome. I loved him.
Oh yeah, he's awesome.
He was. He was a great guy. He loved fighting, and we got along like fucking, you know, brothers. It was awesome. And I remember seeing him before the game, and, you know, Smitty, we're going to have one. And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. And I remember skating down the ice, and I could hear him in back of me, like, yelling, Smitty, let's go, let's go, let's go. And for whatever reason, I thought he was a lot closer to me than he was. And as I kind of turned around, I just dropped my gloves as I'm turning around, yet he wasn't even ready. And at that point, yeah, he just kind of snapped into the next gear. And yeah. I didn't stop. I just started wailing away. And I felt like a dick after that. And I remember seeing him after the game telling him, dude, I'm fucking sorry. That was wrong. I should have never done that. And, you know, it was great. It was all over. But
well, he was cool about it too, wasn't he?
He was.
Yeah.
He was great about it. Yep. But I did hate myself for that. I thought that was a dick move.
Now, so that one leaves a bad taste in your mouth. Which fight in your career left a real good taste in your mouth? Where you're like, that was the shit. That was, you know, Doug Smith at his finest.
Well, not Doug Smith at his finest, but this is the best fight in my life. Honestly, because it's a little twisted here, but it's going to be my fight with Bia Lois.
Oh, really?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because I didn't deserve to be in the American Hockey League any more than I deserve to be in the East Coast Hockey League. So to get called up on a one day's notice, so to speak, and get brought up to the American Hockey League, you know, the second best hockey league in the world.
Yeah, dude.
And get to fight a guy like Frank Bialowicz, who was at the time the heavyweight champion of the league. He had some NHL experience. I mean, that guy legit was an NHL caliber fighter.
Dude.
I don't know what the politics involved in his career were. I don't know if he, you know, stroked somebody the wrong way or whatnot. But it just seemed like he never really got a fair shake up in the NHL that I thought personally he deserved to stay up there.
He's a monster.
Of course he was.
He's a fucking monster.
And so, I mean, you know, that fight alone was the shit fight for me. Even though I lost it and get fucking creamed. And he made the cover of my book Goon beautiful. you know, that fight was like the, you know, the icing on the cake. Because, you know, I got up to that league. And, I mean, who the hell would ever expect me to get up there? No one.
Yeah, I mean, how like now you get to sit back and kind of look at it, you know, hindsight, and go, holy shit, I played in the American Hockey League. No one gets to do that. That's crazy.
I mean, you can think of thousands of kids that can skate at that level that don't get a shot, or you can think of thousands of guys that can fight their asses off and still didn't get a shot at that level. I mean, a majority of those East Coast League guys that I had just fought years earlier never got one game up in the American League. None of them. Some of them did, but some of them didn't.
Do you think that's a credit to just how game you were at any time to be like, okay, we need you here, especially during the Renegoon era where a team could call you and you were there, man. I mean, you would answer the bell, be there, drive as far as you had to go. There was never a time where you were really like, nah, I don't know. Like, you were just so down to fight and play hockey that, I mean, it had to have been like, well, somebody called Doug Smith. Let's get him on the phone.
I'll say that that's probably part of the ingredient, but I think the other part of the ingredient, and I'm just being straight up, is politics. I knew some high-powered people, so to speak, in the business. I knew scouts in the NHL. I knew people from the Boston area that had connections. And even though I had been retired for a couple of years, I still got that game in the American League because I knew people, and it was just it was a phone call. Someone just happened to call me and said, hey, Moncton, and the American League, their tough guy is down. Do you want to play tomorrow night for them? I'm like, what? I haven't skated in 2 years. No. This is legit. Do you want to come in and play? They're going to fly you tomorrow morning, and you're going to play the next night. I mean, so it's politics, too. And like I said, a guy like Bialowicz, did he not have politics? Did he not have someone on his side, so to speak, that could kind of open a door? I lucked out. I did.
Well, that's one of those great fights, too. I mean, like you said, not your greatest performance, but where the gloves are dropped, it's got that presentation to it. Bialowicz has a fucking wild style already.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it, like you said, you've never been knocked down. You took it. I mean,
I was so glad just not to get fucking carried off the ice on a stretcher. Because, I mean, listen, when you're in the locker room, when you're in the locker room for the first time, excuse me, the first time, and you're sitting next to guys like Kevin McClellan, who won a Stanley Cup, and Andy Brickley, who's played with the Boston Bruins, and these guys are saying to you, you can fight a guy like Ryan Vandenbosch because he's a young kid, or you can fight a guy like Todd Gillingham. Don't fight Bialowis.
Yeah.
He's the heavyweight champion of the league. Don't fight Bialowis. He's way out of your league. That's Kevin McClellan. Now, what does your ego say? Your ego says, fuck you. I'm going after that dog right there. And, you know, like I said, I paid the price, but I wasn't going to let my one opportunity go by fighting, say, a rookie who obviously turned into be a National Hockey League star in fighting in Ryan Vandenbosch. No disrespect to him. He was the balls.
Yeah.
But he was a young kid at the time and kind of at the beginning of his career, really kind of like an unknown, unestablished, but everyone knew he was a fighter, but he wasn't at the level he was as he grew. He exploded. But Bialowis was the man, so that's why I jumped on him.
And Bialowis could really be a character from a horror movie, especially when he had, like, the long hair. He looked like a fucking psycho. Like, he really could. There could be a horror movie called Bialowis.
Right, plus he was super strong, right? I mean, he was probably 6'1", 6'2", 240, thick, mean-looking, tough-looking. And, you know, I mean, he could throw with both hands.
Yeah.
I mean, he had it all. So, I mean, yeah, he was a legitimate opponent. Like I said, he was NHL caliber.
Well, that was a part of your fight game that might have caught some of those hockey guys off guard, that you didn't need to lock up first. You almost enjoyed kind of just swinging first, that they might come to grab you, and you would be already ready to throw nooks.
Well, and the only reason I did that is pure and simple. I didn't have good balance. Those guys had great balance because they had been playing hockey since they were kids. They've all been skating since they were little boys, and so they already knew balance. I didn't have good balance, so if I get into a lockdown with someone, I'm probably going to get thrown on my ass. So for me, just to quickly reach and grab and start throwing as a fighter, as a puncher, because I was a puncher, I wasn't a wrestler, I wasn't a grappler, that was my only chance that I felt that I had, no matter what hand I was throwing with, left or right. Once I get locked in with someone, I'm probably going to lose my balance. Despite my size, I just didn't have the lower body, I didn't have the legs or the balance.
Yeah, oh, you started skating when you were 19, man. There's nothing, like you said, some of these kids were born on skates.
Right, exactly. So I already knew that I had that handicap, and I just couldn't risk getting in tight with someone to get exposed like that. And not many of my fights I get thrown down. You know, most of my fights ended by the linesman stepping in, so I was able to stick to my game plan most of the time and do okay on that aspect.
Yeah, that's it's some of my favorite. When I think about, you know, your career and all that, and you know, the books and the movies, I think about, you know, lines where you're like disappointed that certain guys wouldn't be dressed when you could fight, or you know, you just answering that the best taste left in your mouth after a fight was Bialowis, a fight you lost. I mean, you are just like a true blue collar American dude. Like, you, people could learn a lot from just those answers and parts of your book where guys in particular, I forget the gentleman's name, the African-American dude that was in the league that you didn't get a chance to tie up with.
That was Darren Banks.
Darren Banks. And you were kind of salty about it because you wanted to see what he had. I'm like, nobody's like that, man. That's really...
I had two situations like that in the book. You know, my buddy who wrote the book, Adam Fratazio, he was the character that was Gator.
Right.
And I remember calling him. I had got a couple of games with Johnstown. And Steve Carlson was the coach. He called me up and said, Smitty, he says, you know, I'm home now. I'm all done playing. And he called me up and said, Smitty, I got about 10 games left of the season. We're not in the playoffs. And out of the 10 games we have left, we're probably playing 8 teams that have real assholes on them that I want to see get their asses kicked. Do you want to come down and play? And I said, fuck yeah. And I remember going down, and I remember one night it was against Nashville, the Nashville Knights.
Yep.
And the Nashville Knights were coached by Archie Henderson, longtime minor league tough guy. Archie Henderson played with the Washington Capitals, too. And so Archie had a former Johnstown Chief tough guy, Brock Kelly.
Right.
And Brock Kelly was as tough as they come.
He's a bad mother.
Yeah, he was a bad motherfucker. That's right. He was tall. He was long. you know, he was upwards of 6'6". He had long arms. It was tough to get in on him and land a clean shot. And he was willing to fight too. He wasn't one of those big guys that just fought because he had to. He liked to fight. He was a tough kid. And so Nashville had him, but he wasn't the guy in the roster that I was looking at. I was looking at a guy who was down there on a rehab stint, getting his ass back in shape to go back up to the NHL. That was Troy Crowder.
Yeah.
And so that morning, I see Troy Crowder.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, this is going to fucking happen. I'm going to fight Troy Crowder because I'm going after him. Like, I'll make him fight me, but he's going to fight me. And wouldn't you know, before game time, I find out that he just got called up that same morning.
Oh.
I was like, oh, no. So Adam in the book kind of wrote that I had called him almost in tears, crying that
I didn't get
to fight Troy Crowder. Although I wasn't physically crying, the emotion was there. I was devastated I didn't get a shot at a guy like that. Needless to say, I did get one shift on the ice. I did try to fight Brock Kelly. It just didn't amount to anything for whatever reason. There were too many guys in between us. It didn't happen. And that was my one game in Nashville. but the Troy Crowder thing was just like the Darren Banks thing. You know, I just wanted those guys bad for my own resume.
Right. Right. I mean,
and look what they turned out to be. I mean, Banksy ended up playing games in the NHL for the Boston Bruins. I watched him at the Garden myself. I mean, it was awesome. And I'm friends with him today on Facebook, too. He's a hell of a guy. He runs a hotel and a casino out in Las Vegas called the Big D. And he does golf benefits, and he's still involved with hockey. He's a great guy. And,
oh, that's awesome.
Yep. And Troy Crowder, I lost track of him. I think he's an attorney at this point in his life. But just guys that you want on your resume, no doubt.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And you had just mentioned Steve Carlson, and that's
talking
like
a dream.
Oh my god, dude!
Seriously, as a hockey fight fan, how many times did you jerk off watching the slap shot?
I did earlier today, dude.
Right. So I'm gonna get to play for this guy who wants me to come to his team. He called my house. He wants me to come to him. I didn't beg him for a job. He called me. Talk about wood in your shorts.
Oh my god, dude!
Yeah, it couldn't have been any better. Couldn't have been any better.
And like that's fucking. I mean, you talk about it being in the sardine can, and there's two movies. There's the latest fucking porno flick and Slapshot.
That's it.
And that's it. Those are the two options for right. VHSs. And I'm right. sure Slapshot was played more often than the porno flick.
Way more. Yeah, you never get sick of it for whatever reason.
I always found
something funny every line.
Dude, I fucking love the story and your book where you go into Steve Carlson's office, and if you guys are fucking morons, Steve Carlson is Steve Hansen, one of the Hansen brothers from Slapshot. He was the coach for Johnstown. So you're in his office, and you're sitting there, and you're in the book you describe it like, you know, I mean, he must have thought I was crazy because my head was spinning around on a swivel, my eyes were going all googly, because he has all those cool photos in his office of
himself and his brothers in the American Hockey League and the the hell is the other league you play? WHA.
God,
and
dude.
He played everywhere. And he had some pisser photos on his wall that were great. And most of them were fights. So I was going crazy watching this.
Now, does he own that arena?
So I see actually all three of them quite often. I'm fortunate enough to do a lot of fundraising and charity games and stuff like that with those guys. He's out in L.A., he recently moved back to the Pittsburgh area. I think he's right around the Johnstown area in Pennsylvania now with his wife, Vicky. He has no affiliation with that anymore.
Okay.
I just think what him and the other three guys, the other two guys do is they do just a lot of cameo appearances and stuff like that.
Why the fuck wouldn't you? I mean,
they kill it. They make a fortune doing it. They're still a fan favorite, even though the game's changed. People still love it. And they're pisser great guys. They really are.
My little brother, who, you know, will co-host the Biscuit here with me every now and again, he's probably sitting right now at his house in Michigan with foil on his fucking hands with his Hansen jersey on. I mean, like, that's – those guys – and he's like, just turned 30 years old. He wasn't even alive when that movie came out. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's just fucking cool, dude. Yeah, that's you go, oh man, your life should have been a movie, and yours is, but that's one of the
no doubt.
A couple things about being back in the minors. I just want to ask you a couple fun questions. Do you have any still have any sticks from the pro days where you could go grab four or five sticks and get the hell out of there real quick?
You know what, I don't have any sticks. I have very limited equipment left. I've either believe it or not, I've probably given half of it away to, like, benefits.
Yeah.
You know, people I know that maybe ask me to be a part of, say, a cancer benefit or some, you know, something like that, you know, and I'll raffle off stuff, which I still do today.
You're the man. I don't
really have the only treasured items that I actually have that will go in my casket when I go into the ground. All my game jerseys that I actually played in, and that one ring from Carolina.
Well, I remember, was it Carolina who wanted your jerseys after the season, and you just said, here's the $200 for them, gave one to Adam, and then kept one for yourself for your basement?
That's right. I have one, and Adam has my away, and I have my home, and they're all hanging on my wall in my room right now, all of them. Every game I played in for whatever team, even the one game in Moncton, I got that jersey that night.
That's awesome, man.
I said, I don't want your $500 cash for the game that I just played, and I want my jersey. And the owner just laughed at me. He goes, really? I'm serious. I don't want your money. You flew me up. You're flying me home. You're putting me in a hotel tonight. You're going to buy me a nice steak dinner where half of it's going to go on my belly. The other half is going to go on my eye, that Frank
Vitale. Yeah.
But I want my jersey with the blood all over it and everything.
Oh, and, yeah. I got to play in the AHL, guy. Let me get right. My – yeah, dude.
Exactly. And so – they were awesome to me. Not only did I get my jersey, I also got my check.
Dude,
they loved it.
That's fucking cool, man. Yeah. And then people always really want to know, because you'll hear announcers of games and you know, different stories go, Slapshot's really how the minors were. How close is it to, I mean, maybe your day and earlier, how close is the minors to Slapshot?
Back when I played in the East Coast League, say in the 80s, pretty close. Pretty close.
That's awesome.
Because, because, like I said, if you weren't scoring 50 goals, you had to be putting up 300 or 400 penalty minutes. And if you weren't doing either one of those things, you were just a dime a dozen hockey player. And you weren't going to go anywhere but that league and go home when it was all over. So you had to either put up big numbers by scoring or big numbers by fighting. And believe me, there were a lot of guys, like I said, that didn't go to that league as a fighter but turned into one because they knew – it was their only ticket out.
Well, you talk about guys getting, bonuses for most PIMs in a season, too. It was just a different, in my opinion, better time for hockey.
Right, exactly. Anything to get a guy off his ass and get bring in what the fans want to see. And if it's a couple extra bucks in their paycheck, then so be it.
Was that ever weird, being from outside of Boston and, you know, going to some of these places and you're kind of... you know, the gladiator, the guy that everybody was coming to see, were coming to see Doug Smith. I mean, I know you talk about being one of the, I think the only player that had, you know, like posters made at your time in, I think it was Winston-Salem.
Yeah, I still have them.
There's four of them.
I'm looking at them right now.
No shit, dude.
Right next to me. Yep, it's Kessa.
Oh, man.
They would hang from the rafters. The fans would make posters. And I'm talking, they're the size of a door. Like a door that you open in your house.
Oh, I didn't realize they were that big.
Yeah, they're fucking huge. They would hang off the rafters on the second level of the stadium. And, one says Doug the Thug, and one says, I don't know what the hell it says, we want you, or he wants you, or something like that. But anyway.
Yeah, Doug wants you, the Uncle Sam one.
And it was like a picture of Uncle Sam, exactly. But, shit like that, how can you beat that? That stuff's great.
Is that weird, though, being out after a game at night and people are like, holy shit, you're Doug Smith?
To me, it was, because I just felt like I was still just, you know, a regular Joe from, you know, Hanover, Massachusetts, like I said, who was just washing dishes not too long ago. I guess I'm grateful that I have a decent personality and I didn't shy away from people. I talked the ears off a field of corn. So people liked me because I would shoot the shit with them all night. Like, say, guys like you. I mean, if you and I met up, we'd talk for hours.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah, it's just the way it is. And I accept it. I loved it.
If we ever meet up, my wife's going to be mad because I'm not coming home for a few days. We're going to go have a good time.
There you go. but, you know, to answer your question earlier, I mean, you know, sometimes it felt a little awkward, but it was very, it was a huge pat in the back, in a sense, to be that one guy that the team looked forward to or the fans looked forward to, like, as the outsider coming in to kind of, I don't want to say I was the hero, I was the knight in shining armor, but I certainly was the guy that was going to do the dirty work. I was the guy that no one else, you know, wanted to do his job. And not only did my players love it, but the fans loved it. And that was never more evident than the year I went up to Canada as an import player in the men's senior hockey league
Oh, man.
In New Brunswick.
Oh, man.
And, you know, which was a legitimate fighting league. I mean, it was kind of like that LNAH league.
It sure as fuck was.
Yeah, it was crazy. And back then, fighting was fucking nuts back then. I mean, we're talking about guys like Jacques Mayotte and the Roberge brothers and I mean, some serious names. And so here I am, again, being called Yankee Doodle, coming up from Boston, the only American, not only on my team, in the league, the only American. And I had every French-Canadian guy licking his chops, drawing straws in the locker room. Who's going to get me first? They all wanted me. So it was awesome.
And it's got to be...
I never had to ask for a fight. Never. They were already waiting for me. It was great.
It's got to be tenfold now, you know, especially with your appearance in Goon 2, The Last of the Enforcers, because people that can put the... I mean, obviously, you have the book. I know your face, but you're more recognizable now than you ever have been. But that's really cool that you understand that that means a lot to people, and you take the time to talk, because... I've met professional athletes. Some of them have been a bummer, and some of them have been awesome.
Right.
And it really, if you're a little kid, it can change a little kid's life. I mean, it really can.
Of course. And I'm obviously more receptive to a little kid, so to speak, than some drunken alcoholic man at a bar who
right.
was just hammered out of his mind. But I'll still give him time, too. But I know what you're saying. You got to do it. 100%. You know, if you're going to live the limelight, you got to kind of, you know, go with what comes with it and being a good guy and being nice to people and taking the time to hear them and talk to them. It's part of the game. And I embrace it.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Back to your minor days. What was the best, like, gas station food you could get for cheap? And And maybe you can
nothing's changed today as it did back then. It's the same bullshit. Dogs on that spinning wheel that had been spinning for like 4 weeks.
Oh yeah, buddy. Two for two.
A dried out pizza, you know, candy bars, bag of chips. It's the same bullshit garbage as you would find today. Nothing's changed.
That's great, man. What do you think the biggest difference between fighting on ice, boxing, and street fighting? What is there any correlation to any of them, or are they all three pretty separate?
They're all separate, and the ice thing obviously is the hardest. I mean, to balance yourself on skates, I never realized how hard it was actually going to be. I mean, the blade itself is so thin. I wasn't used to being in a pair of skates my whole life, so it was definitely like a new shoe, a new fit, a new feel. And to be a fighter, a boxer, like I had been, a competitive amateur boxer, where you fight flat-footed, so to speak, to learn how to push with the balls of your feet as you throw punches, you incorporate your hips and your back and your shoulders into every punch. Where you go onto the ice, you have no push because you're sliding now.
Right.
You're not using your hips and you're not using your back. You're basically just throwing it with your arms and shoulders alone, like machine gun style. You know, there was a lot of difference, and it was tough for me to kind of learn how to do that.
But you had that huge advantage that your father, you know, had sparred with you enough when you were little that your eyes didn't water up when you got hit in the face. It's kind of like Floyd Mayweather, when they say he doesn't blink when he's punched in the face because he's been hit so many times. And you know, if you do something so much, it's just going to become second nature.
Of course. Of course, and that was true. I mean, you know, a lot of guys that I would punch in the face, you could see their eyes literally well up quick because they weren't used to getting socked in the nose.
Yeah.
And, you know, not like I was, you know, I had just been trained that way. So that didn't affect me at all, fortunately.
Well, and you say, too, in the book, you go, I fucking knew the second I had them, how their face was. Like a face, you know.
Right.
It's 1,000 words. So whether they're,
right.
You could tell instantly, like, oh, this is going to go really good for me, or this guy's coming. But you're still never afraid, just because that's just how you are. That's just Doug Smith. He's just, I mean, not, you know, to toot your own horn or anything like that. You weren't afraid of guys, and you could take a punch.
Even that Bialowis fight, I mean, I absorbed a couple of really good, hard, solid shots from him in a wicked uppercut.
Yeah.
And I remember after that fight, you know, my face was really beaten up. And I remember talking to a couple of people after that game, a couple of players. And they said, they were like, dude, I can't believe you're still standing. That kid hit you solid.
Bro, I fell down watching it earlier. That fucking fight is brutal, dude.
But I mean, in all honesty, I mean, that's really just, I guess it's fortunate that I had, like I said, a fighting background. I've been punched plenty of times. I know how to take a punch. And, you know, my whole game plan after getting whacked like that, I knew he caught me with a good one. I was trying to pull him in a little bit and try to reassert myself and get going again. But I kind of ran out of time, and I couldn't get that right hand of his free. I couldn't tie him down. He was just swinging away like a madman. He was super strong, like I said earlier. But again, like I said, I was just so proud of that fight, just not getting KO'd, because I would probably think that most other guys would have gone down from that shot, and I think I was just very fortunate not to.
Yeah, you're very correct in assuming that. I've just got a few more questions for you here, Doug, before we get into and I've never done this before, so this is pretty exciting. I've got some fan questions after. I've got a few more personal ones. Just because of the character you are, it's like, man, I got to get the fans involved in this shit.
Yeah.
But just a few more from me. I look at your career and I look at your life and I've read the books. I'm a huge fan of the movies. I'm just a big fan. And I go, when I think about Doug Smith, I go, are you only interested in the hardest fucking things to do on the planet? Like, police officer, fucking boxing as a kid. Oh, I'm going to play ice hockey, but no, I'm going to be an enforcer. Writing a book, coaching high school. Oh, and then coaching them successfully to 3 state championships or whatever it was.
Right.
Do you just look at life and go, what's the fucking hardest thing I can do? Then let me go do it.
I don't think I looked at it that way. I just thought, you know, in my head, there were just passionate things that I had that I wanted to do. I mean, you know, the coaching thing was just trying to help kids. You know, I said to myself, if I can make it to pro hockey in 2 years, what kid couldn't look at that and say, wow, what an inspiration this guy is?
Yeah, right.
And I did it the hard way. I mean, I fought my way onto teams. I fought my way into leagues when it was allowed. I mean, there's no harder way to do it.
Right.
And so coaching, I thought maybe, you know, I could show and teach the kids, you know, that hard work does pay off, because I broke my balls 7 days a week all the time trying to, you know, reach and get that dream of mine that I had. And so I didn't really consider coaching to be a hard job. I mean, yeah, it's timing and you know, it takes a lot of your schedule and your family life, personal life, but it was certainly enjoyable to do, which is why I stayed with it for 21 years. I loved it. You know, and being a cop, again, you know, I was a cop on the ice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just know that it's just in me. It's who I am. It's my personality. It's my persona. I want to help people if I can. You know, I'm not out looking for the bad guy, so to speak. I'm not looking for a gunfighter. I'm not like a maniac that way. I'm just looking at it like, you know, listen, if someone needs help, you can count on me. Give me a call. We'll help you. And that's what the police do.
Yeah. I've always thought, and I live in a relatively small town, that I really truly believe that cops, police officers, should live in the community that they are protecting, because I think it means so much more to the people. Obviously, it's hard to do in New York City or Boston, but I don't think it serves anybody anything to have a guy, say I live in my town and the guy drives an hour, and I'm not trying to say don't hire a guy, but it seems to it seems to be like, oh, that guy's coaching my kid's soccer team. It seems to work better that way.
Yeah, because you get to know somebody personally, not just the badge.
Right.
And trust me, I already know, and a lot of the public knows this, people change when they put a badge on their chest. You know, some guys change for the better, and some guys just turn into assholes.
Right.
And we all know that. So you're right. If you can live in the community that you work in, and people get to see the personal side of you, you know, my little boy goes to school with your little boy, and we play games together, soccer, we coach together, you get to see the personal side. It does help. It makes that tension, if there is any, go away.
Absolutely. Now, my last question here before the fan questions is, do you watch boxing or UFC at this point? Because I know you're a big fight guy, and I know there's a big UFC fight tonight, and then there's a huge heavyweight Wilder versus Tyson Fury coming up too. So I was just curious if you have that interest still in combat sports.
I do. I still watch it. I would probably say I've watched that 100% more than I even watch hockey.
I could imagine.
I don't even think I watch hockey that often anymore. In fact, I can tell you that the other night, I mean, the Bruins are on. and the caps are on and the pens are on, and I watch golf. So there you go.
Probably saw as many fights too.
Yeah, exactly. So I still like boxing. I still like UFC. You know, I love when they have the big cards, like you said, the heavyweight bouts coming up with Dante Wilder and
yes.
Fury and the UFC. You know, I mean, say what you want to say about Dana White.
Yeah.
But I mean, listen, he's killed it.
He has.
He's gotten some really incredible fights together over the years.
So I don't know why people hate on him so much. He's a self-made
billionaire.
Good for him, man.
Right, exactly. And even if guys screw up, he always gives them a second chance. I mean, look at that crazy Irish guy there. He went nuts throwing the chair through the bus. He was all done.
Conor McGregor.
Yeah. And next thing you know, he's in the ring a year later, making him a fortune.
Yeah,
so
buddy.
It's all good.
So we talk about the heavyweight fight. I'm getting fucking amped up for it. I know who I've got in the fight. I just want to get your prediction of the Deontay Wilder-Tyson Fury fight. Obviously, everybody really wants to see Deontay Wilder versus Joshua, but Joshua turns out to be this huge pussy. So who do you got in that fight?
It's a tough call.
It is.
You know, I love Fury's mentality.
He's really awesome.
He talks a good game.
He does.
But I'll tell you what, though. Now, when I watch him sparring and watch him work out, I just think he's a little slow.
He is.
Something about him. And Wilder is just that. He's wild.
He's a fucking animal.
He's got those fucking crazy windmill right hands that come from nowhere. If he catches Fury, he's going to knock him out cold.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if I would put money on it because it's a tough call, but I guess between you and I, I'll pick Wilder.
You're goddamn right, America, buddy. You're goddamn right. That's who I got, too. And I think when it comes down to it, I think Fury's going to try to slow fight him, kind of sweet science him. And I think, you know, Deontay, he'll play the game. He'll do the boxing shit. But when it comes down to it, those last two rounds, which it will
go. They get slugging.
Yeah, it'll go 12 rounds. But I think in that 12th round, I think he's going to put fucking Tyson on his fucking back.
Yeah.
I really do, man.
Could be.
All right, Doug Smith, the history is about to be made. It's the first time I've ever done fan questions.
All right, let's hear it.
Let's do it. And for all the fans that sent the questions in, thank you. I didn't write down your screen names because most of you have fucking stupid screen names, and I didn't feel like reading Periwinkle John Tim B 11063.
I got you. Well, let's throw this out there. Any of those people that want to find me, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram. They can find me anywhere.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you can supply them with my info. So if they ever have further questions or whatnot, feel free to send them away. I'm open book about that.
Absolutely. So the first fan question is, and this is asking a guy who's averaged almost 7 PIMs per game in his career. What was the most PIMs you had in one game that you can recall?
You know what? Honestly, I was more or less just a straight up major penalty guy. You know, I just fought.
Yeah.
I wasn't out there getting the 2 minutes for hooking, 2 minutes for slashing. They didn't have an instigator back then. You know, once in a while, I can only recall a couple of times getting a misconduct, maybe for whatever reason. So how many PIMs in one game? You know, I probably would get between 10 and 20 tops.
Right.
I wasn't that guy that got like 65 penalty minutes in one game because I went mental. Because I never went mental. I always stayed in control.
Oh, if they had the instigator rule in your day, you'd have about 300 plus more.
Probably. But, I mean, nevertheless, like I said, I just kind of stayed in control. I wasn't one of those snap cases that went berserk. And maybe that's another good thing in my resume because
for
scouts
sure.
and coaches would see that and they'd say, well, at least the kid's not fucking nuts. And if I bring him in here, he could be a problem.
The next question is, how much involvement did you have in the movies Goon and Goon 2 and your memoir?
So the books I had a lot to do with because myself and my buddy Adam Fantasio, who I mentioned earlier, were the co-writers together. So we put those books together.
That's how I figured.
The movie itself, though, honestly, I didn't have as much involvement as I would have liked to, number one, or that people probably think that I did. You know, the movie's probably 30 or 40% realistic to the book.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is all, like I said, Hollywood script.
Yeah.
And I was consulted a few times during the making of the first movie. You know, they would ask me certain scenarios. What would happen if this happened? Or give me some more descriptions of the bus or do this, but not as much as people would have thought. So it's mostly Hollywood that wrote that script.
Yeah. And I mean, how was it being in the second one?
Oh, it was awesome. I mean, I should have been in the first one, according to Jay Baruchel.
For sure.
Because he had said to me, Smitty, we wanted you in that movie, but long story short, they had at the time they had Canadian labor laws, and that first movie was actually funded by Canada.
They put up
the majority of the money for that movie, which entailed they stipulated only Canadian employees, and even Baruchel said we begged them to have you in the movie because you're the subject of the movie, and they said no.
Well, that's so weird.
Yeah, I know. And I kind of understood it, the way he explained it. The second movie was independently funded, so they were able to put in whoever the hell they wanted, which is how I got into the second one, which was incredible to be with, you know, old buddies like Colt Noir and NHL guys like George LaRocque and George Parros and Mel Angelstadt. I mean, all these guys were like me. We're in the locker room, like, smiling and laughing, saying, this is unbelievable. We're going to be in a fucking movie.
Yeah, dude.
So it was cool. It was cool.
And there was actually an event like that on pay-per-view way back in the day, wasn't there? Like
I remember that. Yep. It was up in Canada. It was during the summertime. I remember that. It was kind of a flop. It didn't end up going that well. But I remember that event. It was insane.
Yeah, man. that's just wild that it actually happened. Because people probably watch that movie and go, well, that never happened. They could have never done anything like that.
Right, right.
But they absolutely did. Like you said, I think it didn't go very well at all.
It didn't go very well, but I know a lot of those guys from the – what league is that called again? The LNHA?
LNAHA or some fucking like that, yeah.
I would say the majority of those contestants in that contest were from that league. And the guy who I think won it, his name was Derek Parker. And he was a notorious tough guy up in that league. I mean, I'm talking 400 or 500 penalty minutes a year. Real fucking dog.
Bialaya's fought in that league too, I think, when Morasti and Bossy, there's some bad, that league was fucking insane.
Yep, for sure.
Now, you did some training for guys like Colton Orr, John Scott, you do any of that now?
I don't really do it anymore now. I think it's just because I'm a little bit older, I'm not as strong as I used to be, but back in the day, you know, long story short, I lucked out. I got to be friends with a lot of Boston Bruins people and the coaches, Mike O'Connell, some scouts, and somehow I was able to convince them that I could go on the ice and teach the hockey players, not the fighters, the hockey players, like the European kids, the college kids, how to defend themselves. Not to be goons or be fighters, but just how to defend themselves. And they all felt that that was actually a pretty good idea. You know, all these players we have, this is a giant investment in our organization. And if they're out there scared or they don't know what to do if a scrum breaks out, let's bring Doug in and, you know, have him on the ice during practice time. And he can work with these guys and teach them how to tie people up and, you know, throw punches and shit like that. And that's how it started. But it ended up snowballing and it went out of control because from that point on, it was all about fighting outright. I had guys like Colt Noir and Brendan Walsh and Doug Dole and Trevor Gillies and all kinds of Dennis Bonvie, all kinds of guys
that came
through the Bruins organization over the 8 or 9 years I was down there. And the fighters really, you know, were into it. They loved it because this is special training they never got from anyone. I mean, you get skating instructors and you get, you know, power play and all this other bullshit. But for the fighter, what do you get? You get nothing. You get no one teaching you how to defend yourself or how to work on your craft. And that's what I did. And again, there's plenty of videos on ice that show me on YouTube doing that shit.
Yeah, man. Now, the next question is, did you have a lot of fun writing the book or was it a hard task? How was the experience getting the book together?
The book was kind of hard, believe it or not. Even though I tried to tell my story kind of like in a chronological order from beginning to end, obviously. But it was tough to get real facts down and to really figure out times and dates and places. And Adam really wanted to make it respectable by reaching out literally to every single guy that I ever fought and get a quote from them.
Yeah.
But he did it.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he's a fucking madman. He was able to locate all these people over the, and we're talking years and years later after playing, he was able to locate these people, these guys, and, you know, try to tap their memory. Do you remember Doug Smith? Do you remember this? Do you remember that? And most guys have pretty damn good memories, and they would recall a fight or numerous fights, and it kind of gave the book an extra pat in the back.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of the book is there are all them quotes from right. some said guys.
And a lot of those quotes, and Adam told these guys, you know, he would say, listen, this isn't about patting Doug on the back and being a great guy. Tell me the truth.
I mean, right.
Was he an asshole? Did he win the fight? Did he lose the fight? How did you, you know, I want realistic stories. And guys were truthful. It was great.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. How do you feel about the softness in the NHL today?
Well, I said it earlier. I hate it. I'd rather watch golf.
Yep.
Which I do. It's sad. It is sad.
It is really sad. And then the last fan question I have, and we'll get you on your merry way, Doug. Before we do that, I know it was Doug Smith Goon on Twitter.
For me, Twitter. Let me see here. I don't even know what the hell it is. I'm lost. I'm on Facebook under Douglas Smith.
Okay.
Instagram, I think, is the same. Twitter might be either Doug the Thug or Doug Goon.
Okay.
I'm drawing a blank right now. I'm sorry.
Well, make sure you guys go all follow Doug on all those formats. And the second edition of Goon, Memoir of a Minor League Hockey Enforcer, is out now. Go purchase that, too. And if you guys haven't seen Goon and Goon 2, I don't know what the fuck you're doing. But the last question I have, and I actually know who this question is from. It's from Fourth Line Voice. And this is, what advice does Jacques Malotte give you?
So I'll tell you, like anybody else who's a Hockey Fight fan, I was fucking out of my mind
when
I found out that the team I was playing with was bringing in the mailman.
Whoa.
Now, I had seen the mailman fight two of my Boston Bruins fighters, Lyndon Byers and Cam Neely, just a couple of years earlier. And so I knew who he was. And I already knew he was a minor league. He was historically known. Never mind for the days that he played in Quebec for the Nordiques. So I was already a Jacques Mayotte fan. And I couldn't ask for a better guy to be with on a team, because Mayotte was the true super heavyweight of the team and the league. And I was the heavyweight. And he always would just say to me, you go after whoever you want to go after, and I'm right behind you. If it gets out of hand, I'm with you. And I would tell him, I want to fight certain guys. Like, I want to fight all those big-name guys that you used to fight. Guys like Mark Roy, who knocked him out in a fight. And then he came back and beat Roy. Rene Labbé, Darren McCutcheon. I mean, you know, there's a lot of guys that played in that league that were fucking super tough guys that just never found, say, the United States hockey in the American League or the IHL at the time. But they were badass, rough kids. They were super tough. But he would always tell me, you know, go ahead, kid. Get your feet wet. You know, go fight these guys. And, you know, if it gets out of control, I'm with you. So, he was a good guy. He really was a good guy. And I was no threat to him as far as, you know, I wasn't going to take his job.
Right.
If anything, he was going to take my job. I mean, seriously, the team that we had in that Miramichi was the name of our team. And for years and years, they were a highly skilled team. They'd always make it to the playoffs. And then they get roughed up, beaten up, and pushed right out of the playoffs every year. And for whatever reason, they finally said, fuck this, let's get a couple of tough guys. And they picked me up. And they picked up Mayotte, and we went pretty deep in the playoffs. But Mayotte, like I said, he could have run that team by himself. He certainly didn't need me, but it was good to have me as a second guy, so to speak, because every team had two or three guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still talk to Mayotte once in a while on Facebook. I think he's living in Dallas, Texas. You know, like I said, for a guy that did it for real, and I mean for real, to accept me and to take me under his wing like a little brother, I'll be indebted to him for life.
Yeah, man, that's amazing, and I'll be indebted to you, Doug. Man, this is this is absolutely a dream come true for me. I when I started the podcast, you know, 110 episodes or whatever ago, there's a list of guys, you know, like my dream team, man. You're definitely one of them. So, you know, thanks for making a dream come true for me, man. I really appreciate your time.
Awesome. Same here. I appreciate you giving me the exposure, and I appreciate all the fans writing in, and hopefully we can all stay connected somehow.
Fucking A, buddy. You have a good day, man.
All right, pal. Take care.
All right, you too.
Holy fuck. How awesome was that? Again, thanks to Doug Smith for coming on and taking the time to talk to the Biscuit. That was incredible. That was a dream come true. Make sure to go follow Doug on all the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. If you have any trouble finding him on there, just hit me up. I'll send you in the right direction. He's got different names on different platforms. It doesn't matter. You'll be able to find him. Doug's a great human. Make sure to go buy his book. Go watch his movies. And please go rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher, and all that good shit. The Biscuit. 5 stars. Just write a review, please. You guys have actually been doing that. We've gotten a couple in the last couple weeks. But to the thousands of you listening, to the fucking 23 reviews I have, it's kind of fucking shitty. So help a brother out. Write a goddamn review. Big shit coming, guys. Stay tuned. I love you guys very much. Have a safe and fun weekend. Happy birthday to the United States Marine Corps. Happy Veterans Day to all the veterans. We appreciate you. We support the troops here at the Biscuit. If you don't, fuck you. And, yeah. Tell your kids you love them. Kiss your wife. Get rid of your dog if you don't want him. I don't know. Fuck you guys. How many fucks do I give?